next case is Travis County versus Flint Hills Resources.
May it please the court, I'm Jeff Levenger for Flint Hills and Coke Pipeline. The issue in this case is whether a pipeline easement gives the landowner the unconditional right to build a rail spur anywhere on the premises, including over the pipeline. The answer we submit is no, and therefore, to the extent that the landowner wants to build a rail spur, it has to pay for the cost of modifying the pipeline to accommodate the dangers posed by the rail spur. Now, the district court disagreed with us on both points, and in so doing, it relied on two principles of contract interpretation, and it got them both wrong. The first involves the definition of the word structure in the proviso in paragraph 5, and the second involves the reach of the material interference clause in the preceding sentence, the sentence that precedes the proviso. Now, I'll address both, but if we're right on just one of those, then the judgment must be reversed. I'll start with a proviso because we believe that the analysis starts and necessarily ends with a proviso in paragraph 5. In your handout, I've highlighted it in yellow. It begins with the word provided, which of course signals that everything that comes before it, it is subject to the language in the proviso. And the proviso is very broad. It says that provided grantor shall not have the right to construct any structure or building over said pipeline after such pipeline has been constructed. There can be no question that a rail spur is a structure within the common definition of the word structure, which is simply a piece of work that's artificially built up over something. And under this definition, the grantor does not have the right to build a rail spur over the pipeline. That ends the analysis from our point of view.
What about item two?
Access by rail or road? Well, two answers to that, Your Honor. First of all, that, of course, is subject to the proviso.
You can build it, but you can't?
Well, you can build it anywhere on the premises. You just can't build a rail spur in a way that crosses over the pipeline, because that's what the proviso says. In addition, I'll come to it in a moment.
The pipeline went right along the side of the property where they would put the rail spur.
Right. The pipeline went in a northeasterly direction. The railroad track also went parallel to that in a northeasterly direction. Their contention is that, gee, that makes it impossible for us to access the railroad track. Well, number one, there's no evidence of that. And number two, in a practical sense, we're not saying that they cannot build a rail spur over the railroad track.
I want to hone in on that, because I saw that in your briefs, and that kind of threw me a bit.
Mm-hmm.
What's your argument under the language of the easement that yes, they can build it, but they have to pay the cost to deepen the pipeline?
Well, first of all, our position is that they cannot build it under the proviso that they're prohibited from building it. If you disagree with that, then we lose. We have to bear the cost, obviously, of modifying the pipeline to accommodate that rail spur. But if we win on that, if the court agrees that they're prohibited, the record is uncontroverted that Flint Hills and Coke Pipeline have said, yes, you can build it, but now this brings into play.
So you're not saying you have a legal right. You're just out of the kindness of your heart, if you win and we say, no, you can't build it, you're going to say, okay, you can build it, but at your own expense.
It's that, but it also ties into the Texas Health and Safety Code 756.123 subpart 2, which says that if the pipeline operator determines that the building of some structure that crosses over a pipeline is going to pose a danger to either the public or to the pipeline, then the builder has to pay for the cost of fortifying.
But that's the question of whether they can build it in the first place. You're saying they can't build it, period, so that statute would never come into play under your argument. I'm just saying, you put it in your brief a couple of times, well, wait a minute, we've always said if you pay for it, it's not a problem, so what are we to do with that admission from you in construing this easement?
Well, we first take the position, well, because their declaratory judgment was two counts. Count one was that they have the right to build a rail spur over the pipeline. We say, no, you don't. Look at the proviso. And then count two was, not only do we get to build it, but you have to pay for the, you, Flint Hills, have to pay for the costs of modifying or fortifying the pipeline. And we're saying, no, you're wrong on that count, too, because look at the Texas Health and Safety Code, which shifts the cost to the builder. So that's why we're taking both positions. It's
just been... The builder of the rail or the builder of the pipeline?
I'm sorry? The builder of the railroad spur, yes. That's the way the Texas Health and Safety Code
you
reads.
You didn't brief any of the Texas cases on dominant and subservient estates. Why not?
Well, I think implicitly we were employing the analysis, but...
Like there's a Sinclair case. There's some cases out there that talk about dominant subservience of states, and why,
right.
Did you think they weren't helpful, or why didn't you...
I didn't think they were especially helpful.
Why not?
Well, because we read the cases like DeWitt and others that basically said you construe an easement like any other contract, and the principles of contract governed here. Coupled with, I think, a very important doctrine which the district court overlooked, which is that reservations, which would be the language preceding the proviso, are construed against the grantor and in favor of the grantee, i.e. us. And I think that's kind of an underlying principle that also dictates a ruling in our favor when you read the proviso and couple it with the preceding language. But the dominant serving and state distinction, Your Honor, I thought was less helpful than simply contract principles that that provisos have to be given effect, that all words must be given meaning, and that reservations are construed in favor of the grantee. What was key to the district court was the idea that structure simply means a building. In other words, the court adopted a narrow, restricted definition of the word structure. And we think that reading has three problems. First and most importantly, I think it creates absolute meaningless surplusage. If structure means only a building, then the parties would not have used both words in the same sentence. Clearly, structure has to have some meaning beyond just building, and it's a broader definition that is broad enough to pick up and include a rail spur. Also, the court ignored the word any that preceded the word structure. Any, of course, is a broad word. It connotes a broad interpretation of the word that follows it. Here is structure. It makes this case very similar to the Texas Supreme Court case of Stewart versus Welch, where the court broadly construed the phrase, quote, house or structure of any kind, close quote, to include a fence. And key to the court there was the phrase of any kind. It loaned itself to a broad definition of the word structure. And I think the third problem with the court's restrictive reading of the word structure is that it leads to an anomaly. It would mean that a landowner cannot build a building, but it could build over the pipeline, but it could build something else over the pipeline in the nature of, say, a fire pit. And that makes no sense at all. Structure has to have a broad meaning that courts customarily give it. Relatedly, I'd say there's also a problem with Travis County's use of the justum generis doctrine.
Well, before we move on from the easement language, the easement gives the grantor the right to access by rail. Then it says the grantor shall have the right to construct and maintain rail spurs. But then the last sentence says that you can't construct any structure if you presume that's a rail spur.
Right.
Over the pipeline after the pipeline has been constructed. So do you think the timing is what controls this entire issue? In other words, once you've completed your pipeline, all these other rights regarding any contact or in the area of the pipeline would be sort of non-existent.
Well, I think the proviso does make the timing important, yes, because...
Why isn't it controlling?
It may well be. You know, once the pipeline is...
What's your easement? I mean...
Once the pipeline is placed in the easement, which it was by November, I think late November of 1989, then at that point the proviso comes into play and it says that no structure or building shall be built over the existing pipeline. It's really that simple. They complained that, oh gosh, that only gave us a small window of opportunity to build what we wanted to build. That may well be true in retrospect.
Before the completion.
Right.
I mean, I don't know if you can do that. How do you build a rail spur over a pipeline if you still haven't put the pipeline in? But
I think it's probably possible.
It had to be, what, 4 feet, buried 4 feet? Now it has
right.
to be 8 feet? Is that
the easement required it to be 4 feet. The industry standard for a pipeline crossed by railroad track is at least 6 feet.
How long was that industry standard in effect? Do we know?
You know, I don't know, Your Honor. In the record, they talk about an American Petroleum Institute standard dating from 2007. I wasn't able to determine if that was in place back in 1989, but I would think something of that nature would have been in place that not only would provide for a certain depth.
Not in the record one way or the other?
Not in the record one way or the other, no.
What does the industry standard say about putting houses or barns or inhabited dwellings on top of a pipeline?
I don't know.
It's not in the record either.
Not in the record. The only regulations they talked about in the record concern railroad tracks crossing pipelines. Although I would assume that Texas Health and Safety Code 756, which talks broadly in terms of structures, would maybe pick up houses and barns and that type of thing. But whether it would require the same depth and the same wall thickness of the pipe, I don't know. Moving off the proviso for a moment, I wanted to say a word about the preceding language. The district court, in my view, also erred in its interpretation of the preceding sentence, which contains the material interference clauses. Importantly, there are two possible interpretations of that preceding language. Neither one of them supports the conclusion that Travis County had the unconditional right to build a rail spur over the pipeline. Now, under the first interpretation, which is the one we promote, the material interference clause modifies every word in the list. So it would modify rail spur, among the other things, and naturally a rail spur that crosses over a pipeline materially interferes. So under our interpretation, the preceding clause simply provides another reason why they cannot build a rail spur over the pipeline. I think the court's analysis was wrong from a grammatical standpoint. It ignored the fact that this which does not materially interfere language is considered to be a restrictive dependent clause, and I think the court's reasoning also creates an anomaly, again, in which landowners could build heavy structures like parking lots and rail spurs and that type of thing that materially interfere, whereas they could not build lesser structures that materially interfere, such as towers or billboards or something of that nature. But importantly, even under the court's interpretation, in which it said that the material interference clause modifies only the immediately preceding word, other item or other usage, we still win because it still does not mean that the landowner has an unconditional right to build a rail spur over the property. Here's what it means. It means that the landowner can build a rail spur or a fence, a road, a parking lot, et cetera, anywhere on the premises, including in some location that materially interferes, so long as it doesn't cross over the pipeline. And that way you're giving effect to both the proviso, which prohibits building over the pipeline, and you're giving effect to the preceding sentences that are all subject to the proviso. And I think it's also supported by the rule I mentioned earlier that you must construe reservations in favor of the grantee and against the grantor. I want to address one contention that Travis County makes about intent, and I submit to you that in doing so they tend to look outside the four corners of the agreement, which in my view starts and ends the analysis. But they say, for example, that Flint Hills could have built a pipeline in a manner that would not interfere with a railroad track. We could have buried it deeper, and therefore we should be blamed for not having done so, and therefore we can't seize upon the language in the proviso. I think that argument ignores the plain language of the easement, which required only that the pipeline be buried to a depth of 4 feet. It didn't say deeper than that. It didn't say that that the walls had to be of a particular width. So I think, given the fact that the industry standard is 6 feet and the walls of the pipe have to be deeper, That argument they make, in essence, works against them because it proves that the parties to the easement were not contemplating that the pipeline would be crossed by the railroad track. I think their own argument, where they tend to try to look outside
the four corners. Well, if we don't know what the regulations were in 89, that it just, we just don't know. I mean,
well, that's a good point, yes. But by the same token, I don't think you can infer anything in the language of the easement at all, either paragraph 5 or anything beyond that, that would suggest that the loan requirement in there, the requirement that they bury it to a depth of 4 feet, was put in there because the parties were contemplating that a railroad spur or track would be built over the easement. I don't think you can draw that inference at all, and in fact, I think the fairer inference on this record is the contrary, that the parties were not contemplating that the pipeline, once it was built, would be crossed by a railroad track, and the proviso says that it would not be.
All right, thank you, sir. No,
thank you.
Mr. Labadie?
Police Court, good morning. My name is Tim Labadie. I'm representing Travis County. And I guess the biggest problem I have with Koch's position, and I'm going to just refer to him as Koch rather than Koch and Flint Hills, is that they want to focus mainly and almost solely on that the proviso language. You heard Mr. Levenger say it begins and ends with that provision, but as we all know, when we are trying to determine the objective intent of the parties, we have to look at the entire easement. And indeed, the easement is a part of the record, and it is a multi-page document, about 7 pages altogether, I believe. The first 2 pages of which contain, you know, the real important terms and conditions of the easement, and ending with Exhibit B, which is a map, a plat, of the property that was going to be subject to this easement, which is very informative in and of itself, the map, because it shows the realities of this property as it existed in 1989, which is important to determining what the parties were trying to achieve here. And that's really the objective and the task for this court. Is
what in doing, though, I thought we have to read this easement resolved uncertainties against the grantor in favor of the holder of the easement itself. In that regard, I direct your attention to paragraph 5, which you spent a lot of time with, and the fifth line, which is any other usage which does not materially interfere with the operation or maintenance of grantee's pipeline. Now, one would say, well, okay, the other unenumerated, as your argument is, deal with the unenumerated possible uses do have this limitation of not materially interfering with, but the enumerated ones do not suffer that, which the practical effect of that is that this easement that was granted would be that you can it materially interfere with the grantee's pipeline by cultivation, not only by access to railroad, by parking, by drainage, by utility. In other words, they essentially, you would be taking back a great deal, not a substantial part of the original easement itself. So that if that's so, then the way to read that, resolve that, would be against the grantor, which would say that all of these enumerated activities may not materially interfere with the operation of the grantee's pipeline. And it may be that installation of the will not materially interfere with it, I suppose. But you also, of course, want them to pay for it, which I think the latter part of that is a pretty uphill climb.
Well, first of all, Your Honor, I don't believe that the law is as broad as Mr. Levenger has said in terms of construing everything all against the grantor. Now, there is a case, the Houston Pipeline case, where the court said...
Well, forget that standard. Let me just ask you the common sense. Under your reading, they can materially interfere. They have an easement to put the pipeline in, but the reservation is we can materially interfere with it by crops, cultivation, parking, drainage, and utility lines, access by rail?
Well, no, Your Honor, actually not, because if you look at the whole easement, and I call your attention to page 1 of the easement, and in that last paragraph on the first page, near the middle of the paragraph, I think it's 8 lines down, where you see it starts, the said grantor to fully use. It says, the said grantor to fully use and enjoy the said premises, except for the purpose herein granted to the said grantee, which hereby agrees to bury all pipe to a depth of at least 4 feet, so as, why? So as not to interfere with the use of the premises reserved to the grantor. So, and what are those uses? The uses are on page 2. I can build a fence.
But that won't take you anywhere, because you can't put it in there at 4 feet. In other words, you can't go in, and as I understand it, you can't put a railroad track over this pipeline today and leave the pipe at 4 feet.
But
right you possibly could have gotten out of this then would be whatever use you can make of it while it's at 4 feet.
Well, no, but what you had said was that the owner of the property can materially interfere with the pipeline by putting these things over the pipeline. That's what paragraph 5 says. But paragraph 5 doesn't say that. What paragraph 5 says is that the owner of the property can build fences, roads, rail spurs, such and such, and then it puts a responsibility on the grantee to make sure that it does not interfere with those rights reserved to the property owner. And indeed, the next sentence on page 1 says that the grantee is agreeing that if, after the pipeline is put in place, it's fully constructed, if it causes damage to these fences, these roads, these rail spurs that the grantor can put in the easement, then it has to pay damages caused to those items.
I understand what you're saying, but I don't think that's responsive to the way you would read this clause. This literally would say, as you read it, that you can, by each of these enumerated uses, materially interfere.
No, I'm not saying that at all, because we have to look at this easement as it was in April of 1989.
Let's accept that then. Then you cannot then materially interfere with access by rail or road. Is that what you...
No. You have to understand, when this agreement is being made, there's no pipeline in existence. None at all.
No, but it's clearly contemplated there.
It's contemplated, yes. But it's also...
That's the last sentence. It says none of this will happen after the pipeline's been constructed. So if you want to build a rail spur, you've got to hurry up and build it.
No.
Okay, what does it mean?
No. You mean the last sentence on the first page?
Right.
Okay, the last sentence on the first page says that Koch, the grantee, agrees that if it causes damage to a rail spur after the pipeline has been completed by modifying it or operating it or doing whatever it does to that pipeline.
So the rail spur has to be there first.
No, it doesn't. It's contemplating that a rail spur could be put there at any time.
It's not the existence of the pipeline that's damaging the rail spur, and the Sinclair case is pretty much on all fours. It's your the way you want to use the property that's interfering with the pipeline.
No.
Yes.
No, it's not.
The existence of the pipeline is not harming your property, and that's not what the clause you're relying on says. You don't get to...
No, this is what I'm saying. This is what I'm saying, is that at the time this agreement was made, there's no pipeline, there's no spur. what the parties agree is, Koch, you can put a pipeline, you know, the joint venture, 290 joint venture says, Koch, you can put a pipeline through my property on this 10-foot wide piece of property. But you know what? I'm reserving a right to use that property in these ways. I can put a rail spur on that property. I can put a road on that property. I can put a fence on that property. I can do anything on that, other things on that property, as long as those other things don't materially interfere. Now, so it contemplates a rail spur putting on any time, anywhere that the owner decides to do it, instead of being limited to like a 2-month period, which is what they're arguing. And it says that, and so it is not, it is not by necessity a fact that a rail spur will materially interfere with a pipeline. That's what they want you to believe. But that in 1980,
it will.
It only will now because they didn't build it properly.
What were the facts in 89? How could you build a rail spur and not materially interfere in 89? What does the record say about that?
Well, the record does not show what the industry standards were in 1989. But there were industry standards in place to be able to build a pipeline underneath a railroad track.
But you only had to bury it 4 feet, right?
Well, we don't know. The easement says...
How deep was it buried when it was constructed?
Well, it wasn't built... It wasn't even buried at 4 feet.
Well, I thought...
No. The record shows that that what we did after this lawsuit was filed...
That's not... Look at footnote 3 in the reply brief, page 10. It says... The only evidence says that at the time it was built, it was 4 feet. The fact that it may not now be is immaterial.
There is no evidence in the record of the depth that it was built in 1989. Absolutely none.
I don't think I'd be finding that out before I wanted to put
none.
Something over.
It says,
but there is evidence.
What he cites to record site 180. What's at page 180 of the record?
There is an affidavit, I believe, from somebody from Koch, actually it's a letter from one of their experts that talks about the depth that it should be built at now. That's 180. There is absolutely nothing in the record to show what the depth that it was built at in 1989. There is evidence in the record. We submitted an affidavit from an engineer from Bury Partners, and Koch went out there with him, and they did a test to find out how deep that pipeline was buried. And they did these samples throughout the whole property, and seven samples. Three of those, I believe it's three, maybe four, three of them were less than 4 feet, and one was less than 2 feet deep. So they didn't even comply.
So what does that got to do with it?
Well, that's just in response to the court's questions. What I'm saying is that, kind of responding to your question,
well,
Judge,
okay,
is...
Well, let me be very clear with you, because I don't understand what you're saying at all. Are you agreeing that you cannot put a pipeline in there that materially interferes with it, but maintaining that putting it in there would not do so? What are you saying?
What I'm saying is that the property owner...
Just answer my question.
I'm trying to.
It's a very simple question.
Right.
And that is, do you agree that you cannot build that pipeline, I mean that railroad track over that pipeline, if it materially interfered with it?
I do not agree with that.
You have the right to materially interfere with it, you say?
We have a right to build a rail spur. Whether it materially interferes or not, that is not an issue.
It is if your railroad causes
it is for them. But you know, they entered into this agreement and they entered into this project of building a pipeline knowing full well that the property owner retained the right to build a spur over that pipeline.
Well, I know that. You've said that three times. My question, though, is I still don't understand what you're saying. You say you have the right, you maintain, to materially interfere with that pipeline, and also you have the right to make them pay for it.
No.
And is that right or not?
No, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying
is that right or not, whatever you're saying.
I'm saying, no, that's not right.
Okay.
What I'm saying is that the property owner has a right to build a rail spur over the pipeline. Has that right? No matter what.
And it's not qualified by whether it materially interferes with the operation or maintenance of it?
Absolutely not.
Okay, I understand that
absolutely
argument.
Absolutely not. I'm sorry.
Could I move you to cost? I have a real difficult time with your argument with regard to attorney's fees costs under the statute.
We're not making a claim for attorney's fees.
I'm sorry?
We are not making a claim for attorney's fees.
I don't mean attorney's fees. I mean in terms of the who pays for the cost of this. Assume for the moment that you have the right to go in there. You also maintain that Koch has to pay for it, and I have a hard time under the statute of getting there.
Under the what?
I'm
sorry, I didn't hear the word.
Under the statute which controls...
We contend that the statute does not control because...
Well, I understand you do, but tell me how.
How? Because there is a writing that controls...
So your maintenance... I thought in paragraph 3 you say that the word an agreement means the easement itself.
That's absolutely
and
right.
And the practical effect would that mean that if we say that as a matter of law, that every easement out there it essentially walks out from under the statute itself because... Yeah, instead of reading the statute to say the agreement is between the builder and the balconies or whoever it is wants to do this, whatever agreement they reach. But you read that to say the easement itself is the agreement.
That's right.
And, yes, well, I just suggest to you that would gut the entire easement structure because most all these pipelines out there are under easements. And if that's the agreement, that would mean that the statute itself, which is written by the legislature to put the burden of the expense on the person who would go in and to use the property in the existing pipeline. That's the difficulty I have with that argument.
Well, our position is this is the agreement that controls the parties and that controls the nature of the building of the spur and gives us that right to do that. And so that the statute is not kicked into effect because there is a written agreement in place between the parties.
I still don't understand how this works. How does the statute work? Let's say you have the right to put the spur across the pipeline, but it creates a material risk of public safety. So the statute says you can't build it.
Well, here's there's
because, if it's a risk to public safety, the statute says you can't build it.
Well, here let me back up just one little bit, you know, to let you understand our position, and it's more broad than answering that question. And I will answer that question. The problem I have is that from the beginning, when this easement was entered into by the parties, there was a contemplation that the owner could build a rail spur. Now, what Koch is saying and what your question is implying is that Koch can unilaterally destroy that right by building its pipeline in such a way that when we decide to build our rail spur, we're going to materially interfere with it.
You have not demonstrated that from the evidence. You have said there's no proof that at the time this easement was entered into, that to put a rail spur across there would have been dangerous, would have violated any regulations, would have been a material interference. We don't know from the record.
No, we're talking about right now.
We're talking about this document is governed by what the facts on the ground were in 89, and both of you all tell us we don't know. So I don't think you can say that we have to presume that a pipeline buried at 4 feet in 1889 violated any regulation.
It wasn't built at 4 feet. We know that.
The document said they only have to bury it to four feet.
But they didn't even do that.
Well, we don't know that.
Yeah, we do.
No, we don't.
Yes,
we know what it is today. We do not know what it was in 89. Don't know.
Well, we know it's not buried at 4 feet. It's only buried at...
People can scrape the surface off and make it less than 4 feet. We do not know what the burial depth was in 89. We don't know. So those facts just aren't in evidence. So what we do know is now it's a danger to build the spur across. Well, and the statute says you can't do it unless. Now, take it from there.
What I'm saying is that they built it in a way so that if we want to put a spur...
We don't know that. You do not have evidence to show that in this record.
Yes, we do, because everybody agrees that if a rail spur is put over that pipeline
today,
and that's what we're talking about, today...
But you're saying they built it in a way. We do not know they built it in a way. That's the part that's not in the record. You cannot argue that.
Well, we do know that if they had buried it at a depth of a certain depth, right now we know it's 6 feet.
We don't know what they buried it at. That's my
whole
point. No, we don't, sir. I'm sorry. We do not.
Well, I'm not saying we know what they built it at.
You're saying if they had built it, we don't know that they didn't build it the way you're describing. So you don't win
yes,
that argument.
Yes, we do.
All right, let's just say...
We know for sure that they did not build it at 6 feet.
Running out of time, let's just say...
That's in the record.
Wherever it is, how do you go from here? Wherever it is today, the condition of the level of the pipeline, what gives the right to build the railroad spur?
The right to give the rail...
No pain to lower it appropriately.
The right to give the railroad spur is in the easement. And
but you can't build it, and regardless of what the easement says, the statute will not let you create a public issue.
Well, but it says,
now, where does this
unless there is a written agreement.
The agreement does not say you, let's assume the agreement is silent. Assume with us the agreement is silent about payment. Then where does that leave you under the statute?
The statute says a construction or repair, replacement, maintenance of a construction unless there is a written agreement.
I'm saying, we disagree with you and that the easement does not address payment.
Okay.
Where does the statute leave you?
Well, if the easement is not a written agreement.
The easement.
It's a written agreement, but it doesn't specify who's going to pay. There's no provision for payment. That's where we're stuck. That's where the district court is stuck. That may be where you're stuck. Where's the payment?
Well, there is. The easement does not contemplate payment. It has nothing to do with payment, but it is a written agreement concerning the construction and operation and maintenance of a pipeline running through this property.
Now lowering it to the statutorily approved depth, statutorily required depth, is that maintenance? Is that what you're saying?
That could be maintenance.
You didn't argue it. All right,
no.
We're out of time. Thank you, sir.
Mm-hmm.
I think the court has the...
If this case is about who pays, I wondered if we found that Coke does not have to pay, that whoever wants to build Dow Conies or whoever wants to do this is going to have to pay, then that's pretty clear. If we were persuaded, why do we need to worry about the rest of this if that's functionally what you parted to deal with? If you get what you want, you can go do it, but you can pay for it.
Right. Well, you may be right, Judge Higginbotham.
As a practical matter, I didn't.
As a practical matter, that may be right. But the way the court's order was set up, the combination of the order and the judgment, I mean, we felt like the threshold question was, do they have the right? And the court said they have an unconditional right to build it anywhere on the premises. And we said, well, you do have the right to build it somewhere on the premises, just not over the pipeline. So whether you start with the cost issue or the entitlement issue, probably in a practical sense, doesn't
matter. Let's assume you lose on the right. We say that they have the right to build it across the pipeline.
Well, they don't, but...
I'm saying you lose on that issue. Then where are you on the statute?
Well, then we turn to the Texas Health and... Well, probably we lose. If you determine that under the Health and Safety Code 756.123, Subpart 3, the contrary agreement can flow from the easement, and I don't know that it does.
No, I'm asking you. Tell us what your argument is.
Okay.
Let's say the easement does not address cost, but it does say that they have the right to build a rail rail spur across the easement.
Right.
Then where are you?
Well, I think we're back to 756.1232, which says that if the pipeline operator determines that the construction over the rail spur will pose a danger to the public or to the pipeline, which we have determined, then the builder, which in this case would be Balcones, has to pay for the cost of it. I think that's where we are. They talk about a contrary agreement. I agree with Judge Higginbotham. It cannot derive from the easement, which is silent as to costs. And just as importantly, 756.122 creates an exception when it renders the statute inapplicable when you have an agreement. But that agreement has to be between the pipeline operator and the builder.
It has to be the contrary. It's an agreement to the contrary.
To the contrary, and element one and element two, between the pipeline operator and the builder, which here would be Balcones Resources. And clearly there's no evidence of any such agreement, much less an agreement to the contrary. So
what is the evidence? Just you said in your brief, that footnote, right, that there is evidence you built it 4 feet or below.
Right.
What's the evidence?
Well, I would direct the court to pages 180 and pages 189 of the record. 180 is the declaration of Sammy Russo, who was an expert that Flint Hills retained, and he came in and he looked at the plans. They're among the materials he looked at, and he determined from that at the time it was built, it was at a depth of 4 feet. He said that in his affidavit on page 180, and that wasn't objected to or controverted. Likewise, Mr. Ostrom, who was the Flint Hills affiant, filed a declaration at page 189, where he also said that the thickness, I think he said, was a third of an inch, buried at a depth of 4 feet. Now, they like to talk about the current depth, and yes, apparently at a few places along the way, through erosion or scraping or otherwise, the depth is now less than 4 feet. But I agree with Judge Higginbotham. What does that have to do with anything? It's just not relevant to what the intent of the parties was at the time. I also want to briefly point out that there's no inconsistency between page one of the easement, which counsel read from, and paragraph five. Page one simply says Flint Hills can't interfere, and paragraph five says they can't materially interfere. I mean, they're just mutual clauses, and in fact, as we said on pages 21 to 22 of our opening brief, the key to the first sentence, the key to the first page, the paragraph that counsel read from, is that there be an already existing structure that was lawfully in place. That's the way I read that first page. And of course, we don't have that with the rail spur, because the rail spur is not an existing structure that was there at the time of the pipeline being built. In other words, page one just does not even apply here, is the way I view it. So unless the court has any further questions, that would complete my comments.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.